All right, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guest this week, I've been taking a little downtime and was just, you know, checking out the internet, some, reading some stories, trying to catch up on the news, stay current. And what I learned is I think I need to move out of society. I think it's over for us. Not because of the politics or anything else, just because of the headlines that I see on a regular basis on major, major websites like Yahoo.com. Okay, these are just some headlines, none of them made up. Elizabeth Olsen has wardrobe malfunction in Paris. This is apparently news. Man shoots off fireworks from top of his head, dies. Marriage to slovenly wife brings man close to tears. How many iPhones does it take to stop a bullet? Here's what Kaylee Cuoco looks like without makeup and hair products. Kelly Ripa thinks her husband Mark Consuelos has narcolepsy. 13 stars who are taller than you'd think. Underwear models share their coming out stories in their underwear. Economist Paul Krugman on what's at stake in Greece debt crisis. I'm assuming not in his underwear. So if you want to learn what's going on in the world, don't. It depresses you. Trust me. My guest this week is Spike Ferriston, writer for Seinfeld, wrote some famous episodes like The Soup Nazi. He has a show on NBC Sports called Car Matchmaker, and Spike's Car Radio, which is a great podcast, all centered around his love of cars. We have some great conversation about how he got into cars, how Letterman and Seinfeld in particular, because he also wrote on Letterman, got him into his car obsession. And we talk about watches and all a lot of cool stuff. Really great conversation and a really great guy. Enjoy it. And please keep sending the links around to the podcast and leave us some nice comments on iTunes. And I'm going to be at the House of Comedy, Comic Strip Comedy Club in Edmonton at the Edmonton Mall, January 18th to the 20th. So if you guys are in the Edmonton area and you can walk outside without freezing to death, come check me out. It's on my website, paulmercurio.com. I'll be in Edmonton January 18th to the 20th. And enjoy Spike Ferriston.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. Your host, Paul Mercurio, here. And I've got a very, very funny man whose work you've been enjoying for a lot of years and is a great writer and hosts Spike's Car Radio on Podcast One and Car Matchmaker on NBC Sports, Spike Ferriston. What's up, Spike? How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm all right.
You got downtime right now, so you were just saying you're working out, getting that body in shape, having a little lunch.
I got a workout in. I completely undid it by eating a big Italian lunch, and it's a little before Christmas, so I'm headed to New York to visit with my brother and the cousins. I'm excited.
Very cool.
How's New York? Are you there? Are you in New York?
I'm there. I'm here. It's cold today, which means it'll be like 60 tomorrow. There's no snow.
Yeah.
It's a little too busy even for me now. I'm asking some people to just leave. I go up to random people on the street and say, you know what? There's too many people. Can you? It is busy now, but I just wish there'd be a little snow to really get it complete, you know?
It's a victim of its own success, kind of like L.A. right now, which
yeah.
L.A. is going through. If you haven't been here in a little while, it's the New Yorkification of Los Angeles is happening right now.
In what
sense?
Where
we've grown outwards as much as we can, and now we're growing upward.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, a lot of times I stay in Pasadena with an old childhood friend, and
that's nice.
You know, but that commute in is and out is brutal. It's like
horrifying. Horrifying.
Yeah, and you.
That's why these podcasts work. That's why people listen to your podcast.
Exactly.
It's to undo. They're nodding right now in their cars going, yes, this is horrible. I have something nice to listen to. I have Paul's podcast.
I guess I should I should create, in order to up my listenership, I should actually create traffic jams in L.A. on a regular basis. That would be, just put a couple of dead cars out there or something like that, you know?
They happen. They happen on their own here, spontaneously.
You don't need to.
All manner of mattresses and wheelbarrows just laying in the road and the worst drivers in the world with their iPhones up and their nose in it. It's awful.
Hey, we grew up in the same area. You're from Fall River, Mass. I'm from Providence, Rhode Island.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was born there, but we very quickly exited to West Bridgewater, which is just Fall River adjacent.
Yeah.
I consider that whole area kind of the same.
Yeah.
So, you were either a tough guy or you were the guy the tough guy beat up. So which were you?
I was the guy that didn't get beat up because I used comedy as a way to endear myself to the guys who were tough. Although I grew up in an Italian neighborhood and there were those tough guys. And there is my cousin Bobby who let's just say he runs numbers for an organization,
mm-hmm.
one might call a mob. And the front is a woman's shoe store, but he dresses and looks like John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, but he knows nothing about women's shoes. It's like, hey, you need a size 7 pump? What do you need? And then he goes in the back room. And then he sells stuff out of the trunk of his car. And at one point he was selling like suits, ratchets, and he was actually selling car alarms that he had taken out of other people's cars.
That's awesome.
And
it's charming, isn't it?
It really is.
You're just saying that. It's reminding me so much of home.
Yeah.
And how much I like it back there.
And my uncle had a barbershop, I don't know if you remember, Wickedon Street, just over the line. And he had a lot of customers from Fall River. And one of my best friends grew up in Fall River and then went on to be a lawyer in Boston. I always felt like Fall River and Providence are very similar, like just exactly the way you described it, you know.
Yeah. For me, it was my grandfather was a doctor there at Union Hospital. He was a gynecologist. And my dad was kind of the screw-up kid in the family.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, so when we were old enough to kind of hear about Fall River, it started with Lizzie Borden. It started with this horrible murder that happened in this place. So when I hear Fall River, I always think of this girl killing her father with an axe, yeah. Ratchet. And that's where it starts. Then it goes right to the sweater mills. Then my mom said, but they have lovely sweater mills.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was this mass murder and then nice sweaters. The linguica, exactly. The linguica and the charisse sandwiches. That was the third thing we were taught about.
Oh, your culture, boy.
Yes. Yeah.
My wife grew up there, too. We met in high school, and she lived on the east side of Providence near Brown, and her father was a gynecologist, OBGYN. Chances are maybe your uncle, right? You said your uncle was
my grandfather.
Your grandfather. There's a good chance they might have known each other, or wife's grandfather, because her grandfather was also a gynecologist, and her grandmother was as well. So it's small.
Yeah, those guys had a good business back then.
What I mean? It's never gonna be a dip.
No, in fact, I remember talking to my dad's brother Peter about growing up in that house, and he would tell me the craziest things. He said he remembers when he was young, he would go to the hospital with his dad. I believe this is still Union Hospital, and if the baby died, they just buried it out back in the grass behind the hospital.
Oh my God!
And then he said other babies, other fetuses, they would keep in the laboratory to study, because it's kind of still the beginning of medicine, right? The early part of, you know, this is probably the 40s or 50s. They're still trying to get a hold on, why a baby's born, deformed, or miscarriages and everything else. And I guess my grandfather did a lot of that research. But he said his dad, my grandfather, got him a job working one summer in the hospital, and he thought it would be really cool to take one of these fetuses in a jar home, which he did.
Oh my God. Hey, and kids, I got a new toy.
He was like 15 or 16 years old, and he had this baby in a jar that they would take out and play with. They were very close to another house on the block, and his father came in and he had to get rid of it quickly, and he put it out on the roof outside his window with a girl across the way, you know, kind of like Archie and Veronica in Riverdale, where they live close, and they look at each other, saw this dead baby on the roof and called the police. And,
oh my God.
Very different times.
Oh my God.
Very colorful. Totally.
I have pictures of my wife's grandfather in the hospital, like smoking a cigarette, like in the hallway.
Right.
They would just short of smoking a cigarette while they were like delivering babies and checking.
Oh, No, that was definitely going on with my grandfather.
And then I got a friend.
Crazy Morris Fernstein.
Yeah. And there was a good friend of mine. He's got a picture of his mother, totally out of Mad Men look. you know, in the at a cocktail party with a martini glass in one hand, laughing her ass off, pregnant with him with a cigarette in the other hand.
Like, yeah, that was it.
Well, mention the name. Mention the name Potter. I don't know if your father or grandfather, but Dr. Potter would be the name of my father-in-law and his father. Who would? Chances are, they probably had some wacky, you know, weekend retreats in Seekonk or something like that. You know, for the gynecologist. Maybe they all knew each other. But it's a piece of work up there. It just doesn't. Even though, you know, Buddy Cianci rejuvenated the city of Providence. Still very parochial in a lot of ways, but you know, let's. I want to talk about. I really love the shows you're doing, and they're great because they're so organic. It's so clear that you're passionate about it, and Spike's Car Radio is really a great format where you have a lunch at Malibu Kitchen, and you have two guests and. One guest, as you said, one chair is left for the listener, as you say. And there's not always every episode talk about cars, but you know, you had some friends of mine on, Jay Moore, Dana Gould.
And Joe McHale's coming up, and we've had Seinfeld, Jay Leno, Adam Carolla. Like, Art, the sweet spot for the show is really the car and comedy guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy who kind of has one foot in entertainment and one foot in the automotive world. That's very much like I am, and that's. You know, I'm new to podcasting. I don't quite know how to do it, but it was born
You sound great. You sound like you've been doing it a while.
Well, thank you. That's nice. But I really am kind of in the forest still trying to figure out the format of the podcast and the rest of it. But the simplest, it came about organically, like you said, because this was a drive Seinfeld and I would do on the weekends down from Santa Monica out to the PCH, just on the weekends to grab coffee for an hour at this place in called the Malibu Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And our friend, we came to know the guy who owns it. He was a very colorful past. He was a stage manager for Frank Sinatra and Led Zeppelin, and, you know, always had wonderful stories. Also grew up in Long Island. That's not Zuckerman. No, this is the place where Jerry and I would just grab coffee.
Oh, right.
Eventually, we brought Zuckerman in. It became this, you know, you hear it a lot. A lot of us don't play golf or anything. This became our little old man kind of drink, you know, cup of coffee and drive every weekend. And when Jerry was out, we still do it. We've been doing it for like 15, almost 20 years at this point. And at one point, you know, we were like, why don't we put microphones on this? And people seem very interested in what we're talking about. And they see our Instagram pictures and they want to know. And they go, it might be something. I don't know. Why don't we?
You really do feel like you're sitting there with you. Whatever you're doing, keep doing. Because you really do. Noise. You got that ambient noise that makes that you feel like you're at the restaurant.
Yeah,
and
it makes
you feel
me
like
crazy,
you're hanging out with these guys on a weekend.
Absolutely nuts. But that's. We record either there or we record in Beverly Hills, depending on where the guests can get to. But we wanted to export a little bit of that Malibu sunshine and tranquility and thing that we were experiencing to the rest of the world. That was really the goal. Like, it's so hard to tell somebody about it and go, look, we drive down the road early on a Saturday morning. We stop for a cup of coffee, essentially on this elevated porch in front of a parking lot.
Classic.
And yet it's the most serene, relaxing thing all of us do in our lives.
Yeah.
You know, and we all do quite a bit of different things, but this weirdly, this little drive and then this cup of coffee with friends and talking about whatever, you know, comedy, entertainment, you know, stand up or the cars we drove or the cars that are driving up has become this, you know, ritual pleasure. And I wonder if I can share this with everybody and they'll get something out of it. And I wonder if I'll enjoy it. I do love interviewing people. And as long as I'm putting people in the chair that I want to talk to, it should be a good time for me. So I've been very happy doing it.
Yeah, no, it really comes through and you are a good interviewer. And I have the same approach for my podcast. I book people that I find interesting or I think people should know about who may not be a big name. Or, you know, and just kind of, hey, here's a cool person that does a cool thing that you might be interested in. I am. And I think if you, the interviewer, are interested in him, then, you know, it's going to come through. Like you mentioned Leno, and I always found, you know, Leno was a good interviewer on The Tonight Show, but I found when he started talking cars with somebody, it was like a different interview, you know? Like you could feel the interest and the knowledge and the passion come through. Leno was the reason I got started in this business. I was a lawyer and investment banker on Wall Street, and I went to a private event, and I had been writing jokes, and Leno was the entertainment, and I gave him a bunch of jokes, thinking, you know, you can just have them. And then he hired me to be one of those fax-in kind of writers. And
I did that too at one point.
And then he did one of my jokes, and it just completely blew my head off my shoulders.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
And
very early in my career, the same thing happened to me.
And
it's quite a moment.
It is, and it's like I was making, this a middle-class kid from Providence, Rhode Island, I was making well into six figures doing these huge merger deals, and this $50 joke just transformed me. It was insane. And then I unraveled my life. It's a whole big story. But anyway, I was with Leno maybe a couple of months ago at his garages where he keeps his cars, and, you know, we keep in touch, and that is insane what he's got there. I think he said he's got 140 cars and 130 motorcycles or something. It's just incredible. Have you
Plus
been there?
He really knows. He knows the world, and he knows the history of these cars. He's on a different level than most car guys that I meet, most automotive journalists that I meet. He really is like an historian of a lot of different brands and really knows his stuff.
I think his show's really good on CNBC. I think it really states, and it's... And I said to him, we were walking through, I go, so you have spotters or whatever, people around the world that give you heads up on cars. He goes, nah, I pretty much know everything that's out there. And I believe him. I totally believe, like, he doesn't really need anybody to tell him what's where.
No, you know? once you put yourself out there, the cars come to you.
Oh, is that right?
It's really how it works. Yeah, every day I get stuff sent. And, you know, if you it doesn't take long for you to zero in on what Jay likes and what he's interested in, or Seinfeld or any of these guys, Corolla the same way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people get to know you and what your tastes are, automotive tastes are. And then they start messaging you on any one of the millions of apps that we're on and say, hey, my grandfather has this thing. Would you be interested? And, you know, that's a pretty tight network of car guys who... You know, and you don't, obviously you wouldn't buy a car a day, but, you know, a lot of time I'll go, hey, I know someone who wants that, and I'll send it off to them. And you start connecting cars with people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it becomes a little easier, especially for Jay, because we all know who he is and what he likes. So you go, hey, I know who is going to love this thing.
Yeah.
That's a Jay Leno car. That's a story car, you know. It's got a great story attached to it.
He's got a Rolls Royce vintage World War II airplane engine, completely refurbished. With a giant chrome propeller, like, spread your two arms out. That's how big the propeller. It's just fire engines from 1800, steam. It's just unbelievable. It's like,
it's hilarious.
Incredible. And he's got a full-on, it's completely self-contained. He has his own paint shop. Like, nothing gets far. They have machines that make parts if they can't find the part. It's unbelievable.
Right. No, you got to do that.
And it's funny, you know, when I lived...
He's moving out to Rhode Island. I thought he bought a house out there.
Yeah, he bought a place in Newport. I'm like, man, I'm glad I'm friends with him. Right. I can go hobnob with the rich and famous now. They usually don't let Italian guys into Newport. You know how that is. But,
no, I don't think he gave them the opportunity to shut him down. I think he knocked down the door, went in, and just bought the place.
Yeah, which surprised me.
Furniture and all.
He's notorious for not spending his money. That when I read it, I'm like, boy, I'm surprised he...
Well, he's got three good summers left, let's face it. So at a certain point, you got to spend that money. Where's it going to go?
Where's it going to go? That gray hair.
What are you going to do with it?
You see
how little you need in the coffin when you get in. You don't really need anything.
Exactly.
A paper suit, and that's it.
And that's about it. I lived like two blocks on 79th on the Upper West Side, like two blocks from where Jerry used to keep some of his Porsches in a garage over there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he does anymore. And every once in a while, you'd see him driving around in the neighborhood. And I know you said that, you know, you worked on Letterman, you worked on SNL, you obviously wrote for Seinfeld, famous episodes, including the Soup Nazi episode, which I'm sure you're sick of talking about. We don't have to focus on that. But people should know, you know, you've written some of the seminal episodes on that show. This car thing was just, did you always have an interest in cars when you were younger, or does it sort of just kind of, it just rubs off on you when you're around people like Letterman and Seinfeld who were passionate about it?
Yeah, well, I always loved cars growing up, but I was never really educated about them, if that makes sense. I think you have an idea of where I grew up, like a small town, West Bridgewater, Massachusetts, where you know, what, you know, I didn't have a dad who was like, here, read Rodentrek or Motor. I didn't even know this stuff existed. There was no internet. So you kind of just were like, hey, Scotty Warmington's got a cool car. What is that? Oh, it's a Chevy Nova. It's jacked up in the back.
Yeah.
You know, I liked machines, but I didn't quite know what they were yet.
What did you like about machines? What was it? Just the mesmerizing?
Well, there were a lot of things. To me, they represented freedom. Like, you know, very early on, I was mowing lawns in my neighborhood and making money, and I really wanted that ride-on lawnmower, which I never got. So, you know, to me, just the four wheels, the steering wheel, that's, you know, now I'm kind of driving and I'm making money mowing lawns. You know what I mean?
So, yeah, exactly.
And then, you know, I would go to Betancourt Honda in West Bridgewater and just dream about buying one of these motorcycles because my mom was a nurse and worked in the emergency room and the ER and just said, look, no motorcycles for you, kid.
Yeah.
You're not getting them. You don't get to ride them. You don't get, you know, not that we could afford that, but it's like, you're not even going to ride on your friend's motorcycle.
Yeah.
So of course, that's all I ever wanted. So, you know, it was that. And then as I got older and it became a teenager, it was this ability to drive away from that house to go. I don't care what it is. If it can just take me out of this noise with my
camel, anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Just get me out of here. And, you know, and I want to explore. I want to go to Boston, or I want to sit in the woods with my friends and have a couple beers and, you know, listen to Led Zeppelin at Madison Square Garden on the radio. You know,
We were raised exactly the same way because we would do the same thing. My love affair with cars, I don't collect cars like you guys do or whatever. I would love to someday, but that'd be a dream of mine. But my father always bought Pontiacs. I remember he bought a Pontiac Bonneville station wagon, all power, everything. And we had relatives. His identical twin lived in California. So we would do cross-country trips. My brother, my sister, and I, my mom and dad, and this thing was metal everywhere, no seat belts. Like, so when you got in an accident, like, you knew you were going to die. Like, it was like, and we were always, we would stop along the way. We'd go to, like, the Grand Canyon, whatever, but in between places, my father, we're going to get there. So I remember being in the back, standing on my knees. I'm like, you know, I don't know, 6, 7, whatever. And they would make me pee in a Dixie cup because they didn't want to stop. And then maybe just, like, throw the Dixie cup out the window.
Oh, boy.
But this, everything was power. It was a big white car. It was metal. It was like a tank. And
then when I
was in high school, I was the first one of my friends to get my license. The day I turned 16, my parents, my mother had a Oldsmobile Cutlass 354 barrel. And this thing flew. And it had that angled back window. And we put in this killer Panasonic stereo system, my buddies Pete and I, and we would crank it and just drive around and have drinks while we were driving. And the angle of the window was perfect because the sound would bounce off the window, and it was the loudest thing ever. And then we would take the carburetor cover off because it made the car sound ballsier, and we would drive around all night like some of the best times were in that car. You know, it's a really special thing.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, that had really nothing to do with how that car drove. It was you and your friends and good music and, you know, being by yourself for the first time.
Exactly. And did you so when you started to kind of get exposed to sort of this car passion at this level with Jerry, with Letterman, did you jump in, you know, or was it sort of like, well, you know, I'll buy
it? I got a little pushed into it. I mean, when I was at college in New York, I was supporting myself bartending at Legal Seafoods in Park Plaza, and I bought a motorcycle as my transportation. And that was really an amazing moment, was driving this Kawasaki Ninja ZX600 in Boston, in city traffic, in winter, fall, spring, and summer. I mean, I drove it year-round. I really loved how that felt. And when I moved off to New York, I needed to sell that motorcycle to make money because I didn't have a job yet. And I think I was interning at Letterman and Saturday Night Live. And, you know, luckily got a job 4 to 6 weeks into moving to New York. So I would have run out of money. And when I started working on Letterman, he had heard that, you know, I was a car guy. And I at that point, I don't know what that meant other than I occasionally bought Auto Week and I was kind of interested in racing, but not. And, you know, I was looking, I think I had a Jeep CJ7 or CJ5. But I was just into it the same way Dave was into it. And he would pull me into his office all the time to talk about stuff. He goes, I hear you. I hear you like the old Fords that raced Le Mans in the late 60s. I'd be like, I do? He goes, this is what they look like. Look at this model I just bought. I go, that's fucking cool. That's great. He goes, yeah. He goes, you take this. You have one. I got two. You can have it. And, or he would, pull me up in the middle of the day and say, hey, look at, I remember once he's going, he's at Auto Week open, and he's pointing to a classified ad in the back, and he's like, there's a Volkswagen Rabbit here, Spike, that's got ground effects. And I was like, well, what does that mean? He goes, aerodynamics, ground effects. You should buy this. It's only $5,000. So, it became this way of me to kind of relate with Dave.
Yeah.
Because he was very intimidating and, at the same time, I'm working for him, and
I used to work.
If I don't get, what it's like. If you don't get those jokes sold every day, you might get fired. So
yeah, and you want to, any job you want to bond with the boss. I mean, I worked on the Daily Show, and
right, exactly, report. Yeah, right.
You want to bond, and when you say the it, like, is it the idea of acquiring it, the idea of just touching history, being part of history, like. Because I know you're also passionate about watches, which I am too. And is it a similar feeling regarding watches? What is that it that makes you want to get to that point where you're like collecting these things?
Well, what happens with Dave is I'm buying a bunch of crappy cars over and over again and getting rid of them. $2,000 or $3,000. I keep buying my $3,000 car and selling my $3,000 car. That was it. I didn't have any family or anything else, so I had a little money saved up from this job. Those jobs pay pretty well. And at the time, New York wasn't that expensive, believe it or not. So Dave pulled me aside after I bought this horrible car. It was called a Maserati Biturbo. It was just an awful piece of crap that never worked. I put $2,500. I just wrote a check to the mechanic every week. $2,500, $2,500, a car I paid $6,000 for. And he said, you got to drive my old Porsches. You're a Porsche guy and you don't know it. And I drove this old 911 of his, and he said, you got to get rid of that Maserati and get an old 911. Get whatever you can afford. And I bought a car from a magazine for $6,000, a 1974 Porsche 911. It was it's called sepia brown, but it's really like, a mom would say baby poo brown, with a brown interior, ugly car. And I was in love. And I was in love with it. It took me a little bit to get it sorted and right. And I had it in New York. And when I drove it, I went, oh my God, he's right. This is me. This is who I am. And I love this experience. And my friends would pile into it. And we'd drive down to Tribeca on the weekends. I would loan it to friends and let them, take it back to Boston if they wanted to drive it. It just became this, part of my little family, my friend's family. And that moment, that car is what starts me down the road on that brand. And I take that car with me out to L.A. when I get hired on Seinfeld and pull it right into the parking spot. And who's standing there but Jerry Seinfeld, one of the foremost Porsche fans at the beginning of kind of his Porsche thing.
Right.
And he's like, right car, wrong example. I said, what? I love it. You love these things, but you got to get rid of the 74s because they're the worst and blah, 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 blah. I said, is that in order? I mean, you guys, Mike, these bosses who are telling me to buy stuff, like I had a hard time separating me. Do I have to do this? Are we just having it off the record?
Yeah.
I just don't think that way. And so,
Spike, why are you bankrupt?
All right, I'll sell it.
Spike, why are you bankrupt? Well, because I was trying for job security and I kept buying cars I couldn't afford. So that's
right. Well, at the time, these cars, the car I ended up buying was a beautiful car. I mean, if you know anything about these cars, it was a 73 911 with, I think, 11,000 original miles on it, and just a perfect white on the outside, black, perfect car. A car right now that would cost you $300,000 because of its preservation. That car I bought for $14,000,
wow,
which was a lot to me at the time.
Yeah. Do you still have that car?
A lot for an old car. No, I'm trying to buy it back right now. I had it for about 14 years, and then I sold it, and it may be coming back to me very, very soon.
You idiot! What were you thinking?
it didn't matter. I made so much money on it when I sold it. It's not about the money for me, and I may not buy it back because I don't like I find in those situations, you're trying to buy back nostalgia. It's a visit to the high school, and it feels cool for a second, but you can never really capture what you liked about it. And I kind of move forward and do new experiences. But, you know, being dropped off with Jerry and then, you know, not just working on the show, but we're there 6 or 7 days a week and we're working long hours. And when we decompress, we've got car magazines open and I've got a front row seat to what he's doing. And I'm meeting his guys and the guys who do his cars. And you got to come drive this with me. You know, you're dead at that point. You're dead. And then,
right.
You know, the show is a juggernaut. It was a huge thing happening long before I arrived there, but I'm getting paid handsomely for writing scripts. And I'm, you know, surprised that that's even happening. And that money's got to go somewhere and Jerry's spending it for you.
But it's a good investment.
I'm getting a new 911. I'm talking to the president of Porsche. He's got his hand over the phone. You want one? sure.
For a minute, you probably, it's like when somebody, your boss wants you to have another drink, right? Like you feel, you don't want another drink, but you feel like you should. So part of you is probably like, yeah, well, maybe I should buy another Porsche, but I don't really want to, but I should, right?
I didn't have that many. No, at that moment, let me be clear. At that moment, I only had one car. I had one old Porsche. That was it. That's all I had.
Oh.
And he's now suggesting you need to get a new one, too. And it's like, really? Really, Jerry, I do? I don't have room for this at the house. And he said, well, you know, I can get you a hangar down at Santa Monica Airport. You know where Dave is down there? He got me in. I'll get you in. Okay, what does that cost? He goes, don't worry about it. And before long, I have a hangar. And once you have a hangar and you invite Jerry over, he goes, there's so many empty spaces in this hangar. You know what you need to get? And, you know, that's what happened.
Yeah.
That is what happened.
Yeah.
I'm getting rid of this. You know, I remember one day I'm selling this 73 911 RS, this Tangerine, this beautiful car. Mm. And I said, please don't sell that, please. He goes, why? I'll sell it to you. Somebody has to keep that car in this group, and I don't want to have to. And then, and sure enough, it was in my hangar a week later.
Oh,
and now, by the way, I sold that car to my co-host on the podcast, Zuckerman, and he has it to this day. So that car has stayed in our little group of friends.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. That's fascinating that there's sort of the cars can stay within the group.
Well, in this group, normally goes down.
So when you say that you're a Porsche guy, like I got a buddy of mine who bought a Ferrari, Tony. He had no business. He was a horrible driver. He grew up in New York City. The thing was constantly leaking oil, but it was a beautiful red Ferrari. And then eventually he got rid of it. It was just too expensive for him to maintain it. But his father was a Ferrari guy. What is it about being a blank guy? Like, what is define a Porsche guy to me? Like, what does that mean?
Oh, it's very as horrible as it sounds, just you saying it and calling me that, a Porsche guy. Because I had a lot of preconceived notions about what the BMW brand, the Porsche brand, growing up, the Ferrari brand. I had that kind of New England, like, oh, yeah, Mr. Big Shot. I know, it's always the loser country club kid who might drive that car. Those are the movies characters we grew up with when we saw the car.
Right.
When I first got in the car, I realized how stupid I was because this was, first of all, it wasn't an expensive car that I bought. My first car I bought for $6,000. Mm. It just didn't have extra stuff in it. It didn't have power steering, didn't have power brakes. Very analog mechanical experience, and it felt like a go-kart. And I loved go-karts growing up. It just felt like this, whoever made this, they made it so I would enjoy driving it. And the analogy I would best use is whatever that thing is in your life, your favorite pair of sneakers or jeans or that cap you like to put on where you go, I just like this.
Yeah.
That's the feeling I had when I was in that car, like, oh, I just like this.
It's just indefinable. You're in this moment, and it's like, yeah, this is where I'm supposed to be, and it feels right. I can't really describe it, but
it feels like an extension of how I like things, you know, an aesthetic, like anything that we use every day. It's that same choice. Like, this feels comfortable for me for some reason.
Yeah.
And I wish it wasn't so valuable. To me, that ruins the fun of these cars, you know, but I think what's driving up the value is that a lot of people see what I see when you get into one of these things.
Yeah. It's a passion. I mean, you get that from Jay. It's like, he's not doing it as an investment. This guy lives, eats, and breathes it. And it's funny, you mentioned mini bikes and motorcycles and go-karts. I had that same thing as a kid. Like, I loved the mechanical stuff, and I would just, like, hound my parents for a mini bike, and they wouldn't let me get one.
Of course.
Because they're like, you're going to fall off, you're going to break your head. And I would, like, go-kart. I tried everything. I made my own go-kart, which was basically, we got a giant oak three-panel door, and I took the doorknob off, and I put wheels on it with, like, steel rods, and I built, like, a canopy for it out of plywood. It must have weighed 800 pounds. We put it at the top of my hill in my street, and it got 4 feet, and the axles gave out because of the weight of the thing. But,
oh,
like,
God, that's there great.
Was thing. I just wanted that little...
Yeah.
And my buddy Billy Leo got a mini bike. I was, like, devastated, and I was, like... I got to drive it once, but my mother saw me. She's like, "You're not." It's exactly what your mother did to you. It's like, and I, to this day, I wanted one of those little guys, you know?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I remember the day I opened up the Sears catalog. That was the only toy catalog we got, was the Sears and Roebuck catalog, when they had the mini bike and the go-kart in it. I lost my mind. I went, "Here it is. We can do it right now."
No, exactly.
But it was, I think our budget was $75 for a Christmas present. And my mom said, you know, $386 is not going to work.
Yeah.
And it was devastating.
Yeah.
And I hated the kids in my neighborhood who had motorcycles and go-karts and things.
Yeah.
It was awful.
Yeah. You do the Car Matchmaker show, which is a really clever show. And you match people. You get to know people. You match them with a car. You give them options of three cars based on their needs, their personality. It's almost like you're a car therapist, which it's really great. And I wondered, like, you know, they might disagree with you and want a different car of the three, right? And then have you ever found, like, one of those people ended up being right, like that was a better car for them? Or how's that played out from time to time?
Well, we do a lot of research. You know, I have a team of producers, men and women, who kind of, you know, we put a lot of thought. And we talk to the buyer a lot before we make those choices.
Mm-hmm.
We usually get four or five cars, and, you know, most people have a general idea of what they want. And, you know, sometimes if someone comes on the show and they say, like, I really want this, I'll try to beat them with two other cars and see if I can.
Mm.
But it, you know, the show organically came out of the fact that I helped people with cars, like anybody who knows anything about cars. You're always helping your friends and your family with them.
Right.
And I happen to have a lot of luck with satisfied customers. So people actually took my advice and went, you were right.
Yeah.
I really love this. Or
yeah.
I shouldn't have, you know, the producer who started it with me, Ellen Rakitin, didn't take my advice and called me one day. And she goes, oh my God, you know what? I took Seinfeld's advice. You were right. He was wrong. And I should have listened to you because my car did not turn out the way I wanted it to. He goes, you know, you're kind of like a car matchmaker. And I laughed. She goes, we could sell that show. And I go, yeah, we could. And it, you know, like as you know, the way it works here in entertainment, you know, I'm generally not just working on one thing. I
right.
remember that year I had four or five things out. And this little show, this Car Matchmaker thing. And I had a couple of half hours that I had sold and some other stuff. And it's, you know, it's whatever sticks, you know.
Right.
So.
Well, you don't know, like, it's organic, you know, like the Back in Black segment for Lewis Black on The Daily Show came about because, you know, you sit in that room and you're like, we have to think of a certain joke. And you, greatest comedy minds can't come up with it, but then something happens, and off of that, this great thing happens, right? So, exactly like your Matchmaker story, we go through a lot of footage, a lot of sound bites, and we had these crazy smaller stories, mostly from Florida, where people are batshit crazy, that were not national enough for John to do at the desk, but they were really great, and we were looking for something for Lewis to do, and Lewis is a good friend of mine and my writing partner at the time. We're like, why don't we give these to Lewis, and we'll see what happens? Because, you know, we should try to do them. And we would just get in a room with Lewis and start riffing, and we would just find three stories, create some kind of a through line, and he'd just rant. And that thing just took off. Now, it was only because we kind of didn't know. It wasn't like we sat down and said, that's what we want to do. It was a byproduct of something else we were doing, you know?
Right, right.
And so I find that that's some of the best stuff that comes out, you know, is when it's organic like that.
Yeah, and that's what this show has always been, this place where you know, again, I can go to work every day and have a nice time.
And
it's that simple. And like what I'm doing. And it happened to be the thing that worked out just as easily as it could have been a half hour on CBS or something. And I would have been doing that. We would have been talking about that right now.
Yeah. Are you still collecting watches too?
Yeah, but I kind of have everything I want. You know, watches are a little different. You know, I just sold a ton of stuff that I wasn't wearing, and there are one or two things that I'm wearing. I've got a deal with these guys at Crown and Caliber, this website that found me on Instagram because they saw me posting about stuff, and I wear their stuff for free now every month and try out different things that are kind of outside my comfort zone, mm-hmm. and post and talk about it. You know, they're different though. It's hard to enjoy a watch like a car. You know, I can look at it and enjoy it on the internet a little more than actually wearing it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but, no, I love watches too, and I'm sure I don't have a collection like yours, but the first watch I bought was a Hamilton when I got out of law school and I had a little bit.
Oh, I love Hamiltons. Right.
And then I got married in that watch, and I have it engraved.
Yes.
With the idea that I'll give it to my son someday. And then I wanted a completely different look. And because of Seinfeld wearing that Breitling watch that he used to wear all the time on the show, I'm like, that silver one, I'm like, that's a really cool. And I started looking at Breitlings. It was, and I ended up going, I got a Gerard Perregaux chronograph. And and I love that. And then I bought a Chopard watch, which is that racing line that they have. And I'm with my wife, and we're walking down the street in New York. It's like every other ad is a $4,000 watch. She's like, you don't need another watch. I go, it's not a matter of need. It's just like, if I had the money, I'd be buying a lot more of them. I understand the feeling of that, you know, that you have.
Yeah, I'm using this Patek Philippe World Timer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really beautiful little complication that I got from Crown and Caliber. I'm going to take that to New York because I'm very excited to change the wheel from Los Angeles to New York. That'll be like five minutes of pleasure when I land. I can do that, and I'll post a little thing about it.
Right.
And that'll be it, you know. And it's a really interesting little hobby because we don't really need watches anymore.
Right.
We've got our phones. We've got the time. So, you know, it's funny when you talk about Jerry. I know he wears a Breitling. He has a Breitling that he wears when he's on stage because it's easy for him to kind of check how much time he's done doing stand-up without the audience seeing it. And so that's a real function there for that watch.
Yeah.
And I guess I look down a lot at my watch because it's a little easier than clicking my phone sometimes when I don't have it on me. But do you really need a lot of these things? You know what I mean?
It's so funny you mentioned that because today I pulled out my Gerard Perregaux and I decided to wear it. I hadn't worn it in a while. And I checked my phone 80% of the time with that watch on my wrist. I'm like, what am I doing?
Right, exactly. Yeah. These days I enjoy watches on other people's wrists. Like, so when I have coffee with a friend of mine and I look over and they go, hey, that's the new Daytona. That's beautiful. And he goes, don't you have one? I go, yeah, but I like looking at yours. Yours is way better. It's beautiful. You know what I mean?
That's great. Yeah.
And then if it gets to watches can really also highlight your hoarding. Like if you're really getting crazy with collecting stuff, the unhealthy collecting.
Mm-hmm.
Take it. If you want to know if you're a hoarder, look at your watch collection.
if
it's reasonable, if it's blowing out into the third or fourth briefcase, you're in trouble. You're really in trouble. Nobody can wear that many watches.
If you're into the 20s and 30s and 40s, then those numbers, then you're sort of maybe over 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I met this guy recently who is a Silicon Valley guy who has a lot of, obviously has a lot of money, very successful. And he's got numbers for cars and watches that he never goes over. He believes for cars, the 8 is the perfect number.
How many?
8 for cars.
How many?
7 to 8 cars.
Oh, 7 or 8. Okay.
Yeah, 7 or 8 mm-hmm. is the most you can have, which is right. You know, I've had in that range before, and it. You can run into maintenance. You know, one of the worst days in your life, and it'll happen when you have a collection that's over 5 cars, is something's wrong with every car. and then you're running 10 cars. It's awful when it happens, and it always happens. And don't lie to yourself that it won't happen. But, you know, 7 or 8 is good, and that's a good rotation. I would reduce that number, by the way, to 3 to 5.
Okay.
Be very happy with 3 to 5.
Yeah.
And be driving something different every weekend, and by the time you get to the next car, you've kind of forgotten about it, and it's fun.
Right.
And then his number for watches is 12, which I think is a little high.
High, that feels high to me. Yeah.
I think very high.
I think 5 to 7. You know, you want a sport watch, you want a dress watch.
There's three.
You know?
A dress watch, a sport watch, and then a beater. Hodinkee just made this little System 51 Swatch, which is a $150 robot-built 51-piece movement rubber watch, which is really cool. And that, you know, that's something you can just wear anywhere you want.
Yeah. What's that called again? I might check that out. I'm going to write that down.
It's already sold out. You can't get one. But Swatch has a bunch of other System 51 watches that they sell right there in Times Square at their store.
Swatch, right? Yeah,
it's a cool little watch. You know, it's an automatic, and you can wind it. It doesn't have the battery, and you know, for $150, you've got something neat, and also something you can take a shower in.
I think you need to do a watch show too, back to back with your car match.
I really don't know.
Come on.
We talked about it, and the TV executive said you can't test drive watches.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that was the other thing I wanted to ask you. How do you get away with beating the crap out of these cars and doing whatever you want? You have to give them back if they don't buy it, right? Like, how does that work? Like, I saw you peeling out with a convertible Mustang in, like, the desert. Like, how do you get away with that?
I don't know. I'll let you know.
Have you ever, like, damaged the car when you brought it back? Because you just were...
Is this going to air?
All right, never mind. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ask. I don't want to turn you into a Senate confirmation hearing.
Is anybody listening to this?
No.
Madison Avenue?
No, everything's fine, officer.
Look, press cars are, it's well known in the journalist community, of which I am not an automotive journalist. I'm an enthusiast, but it's okay to beat on those things. What you want to do is test them, have fun, get your shot. You know, and every manufacturer is different. You know, for instance, Ferrari does not want to see any photography with all the tires off the ground or the car screeching. They're very sensitive to certain images. And if you don't follow their guidelines, you will not get any of their press cars. And then other guys, you know, don't care. Do whatever you want with it. But journalists really beat on these cars.
Oh, interesting.
And you don't have to be precious with them, in other words. I started to be in the beginning, but then I realized, what am I doing? Saving it for the next guy who's going to beat the hell out of it.
Yeah. Let's see. Again, all this stuff I didn't know. Well, everybody should check out your podcast, Spike's Car Radio, on Podcast One. It's really, really great. And like I said, you've got a couple of my pals on. And and I like that you're talking about cars, but you're talking about other things. And Car Matchmaker on NBC Sports. Soon to see maybe Watch Matchmaker. Maybe we'll find a way to make that happen. But it was really great having you on, and let's do this again and, you know, kind of get you on again, and we'll talk about other cars and where you are and how big your collection is or not anymore. Maybe you're collecting airplanes in the future. I don't know. But it's really been fun kind of catching up with you.
Very nice to meet you, man. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, and we had some technical difficulties to get this to happen, but we worked through it. You were really patient, so I appreciate it, man.
Of course. I did not want to burden your audience with echo.
Yeah, exactly. All right, have a great trip east, and maybe we'll catch up when I'm in L.A. or you're in New York. But thanks again, man.
Cool. All right, thanks, Paul.
All right, that was my guest, Spike Ferriston. Really cool guy, very, very funny. Had his own talk show on Fox. If you've watched TV, you've seen his stuff. And I will be in Edmonton at the Comic Strip Comedy Club at the Edmonton Mall in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, January 18th to the 20th. If you guys are in the area, come on by. Always a great time, great club. And we will see you next week.